Support for The Bittersweet Life comes from our listeners. This show would not exist if not for the social and financial support of people who listen and love it. If you can pitch in, throw a few nickels in the hat, please do. You can find links to donate in the show notes. Help us pay the bills and keep this show going. You can also really help by spreading the word. If you're on social media or if you're meeting with a bunch of friends, tell people about the podcast. Word of mouth is the number one way that a podcast spreads. And you are the best advocates we have. So please, don't be shy. Tell other people about the show. And know that you have our greatest thanks. Welcome to Rome. This is The Bittersweet Life with Katie Sewell and Tiffany Parks. Hello, this is The Bittersweet Life. I'm Katie Sewell. We're doing something a little different than usual today. A number of weeks ago, I had the privilege of interviewing Patrick Gagnés, a self-proclaimed sociopath. You may have seen an interview with her in the New York Times titled, What It's Like to Be a Sociopath, where she said, "Just because I don't care about you doesn't mean I want to cause you more pain." Patrick and I talked live on stage at Town Hall in Seattle. She has a new book out, and you may have seen it. It's been getting a lot of press. It's called Sociopath, a Memoir. And this is a book that I fully read and a very tricky interview for me to do. And this interview was the very first one ever that she did on her book tour. I thought you'd like to take a listen in on a fascinating topic. In our interview on the stage, I started with the little girl that's on the cover of the book. It's a picture of Patrick, probably around the age of 8 or 2nd grade. Find us on social media if you want to see a cover of that book. Just look for The Bittersweet Life podcast. As I said, this event was presented at Town Hall in Seattle. They do so many cool events, so if you live in the Seattle area, look for a link in the show notes to find who's speaking there next. All right, here we go. All right, well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
First time to Seattle, everyone. Yeah. I have so much I want to talk about, and I'm sure you guys do too, and we will do what we can with the limited time we have. But let's start with the cover of this book, this person, this little person, because that's where you also start your book. What would you say is how you were experiencing the world around you when this picture was taken? Can you give us a snapshot?
When I look at that picture, and this was something I was not expecting, as someone who, you know, struggles with empathy, I found looking at that picture that I have a tremendous amount of empathy for that little kid. When I look at her face, I remember what I was going through. I remember feeling like I didn't feel the same way as other kids. And it was really hard to be a low emotional child in a very high emotional world. And having empathy for myself at this age and you know, the sociopathic personality in general has sort of served as a bridge to help me learn how to empathize in other departments that maybe I wouldn't have if I hadn't connected to that.
Interesting. All right, well, so let's try to fill out what a sociopath actually means before we get deeper into it. How would you define what that means to you and in the larger sense of the word?
I'm always happy when someone asks this question, and if they don't, I try to find a way to work it in, because the number one question I get asked is, what is the difference between a sociopath and a psychopath? And it's a really layered and complicated question, especially since they have reclassified sociopathy as secondary psychopathy. But if we're looking at it from that lens, the true psychopath, we believe, has brain abnormalities that make it impossible for them to move through complex emotional development. So while they can feel the inherent emotions, happiness, sadness, disgust, surprise, they're unable to learn the social emotions, love, empathy, compassion, shame, etc. That is different from a sociopath. A sociopath is capable of learning the social emotions. They just learn those emotions differently. In the book, I refer to it as an emotional learning disability because for me, that's really what it felt like. But the main difference between the two is that sociopathy can be treated.
Okay. All right. And so how would you say that emotions differ for you? What would you say is easy for you to feel versus what is very hard for you to feel?
I feel all the inherent primary emotions, joy, sadness, surprise, but it's the learned emotions. So when a child is, you know, young, they go through a process called socialization when a parent, caregiver teaches them right from wrong and might sit the kid down and say, hey, you know, you don't want to do that because, you know, if you do this quote unquote bad thing, then people won't like you. And usually the child will internalize that feeling and learn guilt or shame or remorse. And I didn't have that reaction. When I got that lesson in socialization, it was sort of like, okay, like I. But I learned really quickly that other kids did not have this problem. So when I was very young, I figured out, oh, not only am I different from other kids, but I need to conceal this difference because when people understand this about me, they start treating me differently. So as a child, sociopaths learn to hide their personality type, you know, out of necessity. It's a coping mechanism. But if left untreated, that coping mechanism turns into a lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. So do you remember, like, do you have a memory of a specific event when you realized how different you were from the kids around you?
I remember my mom sitting me down because I had spelled something incorrectly on some schoolwork. And she said, well, don't you want it to be right? And I remember asking her, can you tell me, do you know what that says? And she said, well, yeah. And I said, okay. The idea that it was wrong or that my teacher might think less of me or I wouldn't get a good grade, none of that mattered. I didn't have that connection the way that other kids did.
So one of the things you write about you remember from other kids thinking that you were different is what you call the look. What is the look?
I don't know if I can try to mimic it, but it's just that look that someone gives you when it's like, I'm not going to say it, but you're weird. You know it. I know it. And we're just going to peacefully coexist.
But I think you said in the book too, that it often would sometimes almost look like they were fearful.
Yes, sometimes it did. It was, there's something off about you. I can't put my finger on it, but I know that it exists. And I remember feeling there is something off about me, but it's nothing to fear. But it's really hard to make someone understand that, especially when you're using words like sociopathic personality disorder. I mean, that word has been misappropriated to mean every type of evil. Obviously, as a kid, I didn't have that language. But even as a kid, I remember thinking, oh, they're scared. And I get it, but I wish that they weren't. I wish there was an easy way for me to communicate what's going on.
I mean, did you get it? Did you feel like they had a reason to be afraid of you?
No. I looking back, I can look at some of my actions and perceive how they might have seemed dangerous. But again, and this is something that I really try to explain in the book, for the large majority of people who suffer from sociopathic personality disorder, the destructive behavior that we exhibit is a coping mechanism. It's not, I want to hurt you because I don't like you. It's, I act out because there's something going on with me. And that's even, I didn't have the language to explain that, but as a kid, that's how I felt. I would have never said that I wanted to hurt someone.
Yeah. I mean, I want to get more to more of that, like why you actually act out. But what would you say, and I know she's here, I'm not going to call her out, but what would you say that was your mother's understanding of what you were like as a little girl?
I think she knew I was different, but I don't think she would have used any negative words to describe me. I think she probably struggled to understand what was going on. But you also have to remember, we were living in a time when mental health wasn't a thing. There were hardly words to describe anxiety and depression, let alone sociopathic personality disorder. So I think that she did the best that she could with the tools that she had, as did I. But I didn't know what was going on with me. And if she had asked me, I wouldn't have been able to tell her.
So would her perception have been that you just were a rule breaker?
Probably.
Or that you didn't listen? Or
no, I think she, I don't know that she would have said rule breaker. I think she would have used strong-willed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Strong-willed. I'll go with that. Well, maybe tell us a story.
Like, Am I wrong?
give us an example of something that you would do that would be abnormal for a child, besides like not being willing to get it right. Like, what would you do that would be different from what another little kid would be willing to do?
I remember living in San Francisco, and we had a very, very tall house. And I remember tying bed sheets together from
family sitting in the front,
going around the house looking for bed sheets and tying them together, because I had seen a ladder in the Sears catalog that was used for fires. So if there was a fire in the house and you lived in a high place, you could drop the ladder out the window and get down. And I was like, I'm going to make my own Sears catalog ladder. And it was probably something that someone from Alcatraz would have tried. Like, it was like, and I kept them under my bed, like knotting them together. And I think my mom caught me. I think finally one day she came into my room and I had actually put this contraption outside the window and was in the process of lowering myself down. I don't think my sister did that or my friends.
But I mean, that is a difference, is that you would be willing to lower yourself down. You'd be willing to like walk out of the house in the,
100%.
Middle of the night.
Yeah.
You know, what were you feeling when you did things like that?
I was feeling. And I think that's what was the ultimate driving force behind so many of these behaviors. I knew that it was wrong, but it didn't feel bad to me. It felt good. And I've been asked, well, why didn't good things make you feel good? And my response to that is, so many of the pro-social actions are rooted in praise, are rooted in that pat on the head, that gold star. Those things didn't matter to me. So it was the destructive behavior, the bad acts, that gave me that jolt that I was evidently seeking.
But it's interesting, because if you got in trouble for those bad behaviors, that did that give you any kind of response? Like, is that just the same as getting a pat on the head?
No, I remember getting into trouble, and my feeling was, I wish I didn't have to do these things. Mm-hmm. It felt like that. It was like, I didn't necessarily want to do these things. It felt very much like a compulsion. So when I would get in trouble for them, I would agree. Like, I agree that I should get in trouble for this. I just wish that the consequence made me stop. Mm. But it didn't, because it always felt like a compulsive action.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's try to get at like what that is. One of the things that you describe is that your brain has a suffocating apathy. It's something that you mentioned. Why is apathy destructive?
It's not. And that's what I came to understand once I got older. There's nothing wrong with apathy. What I was reacting to for the longest time was the understanding that once people discovered that I was feeling apathetic, that I would be labeled as I would be othered, and that I wouldn't have access to the things in life that I knew I wanted. So the apathy itself wasn't the issue. And ultimately, that's what enabled me to redirect my destructive behavior, because once I understood what was causing these compulsions, I didn't feel the need to engage in them. I was able to say, yeah, I do feel apathy, and I don't need to force the feeling, because it's okay. I don't need to be like everybody else. And if I'm othered, that's okay too. But as a kid, I didn't know that. I just knew, I'm not like these other kids. No one can find out about it. So I'm going to do my best to give myself these jolts of feelings so that I am, you know, I perceived as normal.
Yeah. So let's talk about that building too, because it's another thing you describe in the book as a building pressure. It's a pressure that as you're growing up, you describe it as like you need to do something bad so that you don't do something worse. Can you illustrate that, what that's like for you?
Yeah, I remember early on, it was, again, it was this feeling of, I don't feel anything and you need to do something. You need to do something to feel. And the longer I waited, the more that urge to act out became. And I have read research studies and on eating disorders, particularly bulimia. And I resonated with that experience where it's a binging and purging thing. And it was similar to my behavior where the longer I would go not acting out, the more I would feel the need to act out. So what I sort of teased out in college was, well, wait a second, rather than waiting for the pressure to become unbearable, how about I just do little small things? And I referred to it as my prescription, these behavioral prescriptions. I wanted to keep them small, but regular, so that I never got to this place where I felt like I was out of control.
So give us an example of what's something little that would stop something bigger. Like what is, like, give us the contrast of like, what would you actually do versus what you would think about doing?
It wasn't, that's the thing. I never thought, it wasn't something I would think about doing. It was compulsive. So it would just, an urge would just come over me, like, you know, kick over this table or shove the person in line in front of me. But I noticed that those feelings lessened when I engaged in smaller but more frequent acts. And one of the things I talk about in the book is going into people's homes when they were at work. And just the act of being in a space where I knew I wasn't supposed to be really neutralized those compulsive feelings. And I was really disciplined about it. I never took anything. I never disturbed anything. I just existed where I knew I wasn't supposed to exist. Mm-hmm. And then I left. And I noticed that my behavior, I felt what I perceive as normal. I was able to live like a normal person, which is something that I had been trying to do forever.
Mm-hmm. Spend some time with a dog from time to time.
Right, right. I mean, and again, the fact that I was breaking into people's homes and doing these things, you know, that no part of that is normal, but it allowed me to have, you know, the other 23 hours and 15 minutes of normality.
I did love that you pointed out that the one dog that was in one of the houses he went into was like, well, he loved hanging out.
He did. He did.
He liked the company. So, I mean, there's a number of incidences of escalation within the book, both within your family and with your own behavior. But let's talk about the one time you actually physically attacked one of your classmates. So who was Sid?
She was this little girl that lived not too far from us. And I mean, we weren't close. We weren't not close. She was just a kid from the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you do? How did it get into it? How did you two end up in a conflict with each other?
Well, she wasn't my favorite, but that's not what it was. And I want to be really clear about that. It could have been anyone standing next to me that day. It wasn't the person. It was this pressure that I had been experiencing, this inner stress of unchecked apathy, and it had been building, and nothing that I had done had alleviated any of the pressure. And this little girl was just standing next to me, and she just happened to be getting on my nerves. But again, I didn't love this little girl, but it really could have been anybody. Mm-hmm. And I just remember wanting her to be quiet. And so I grabbed a pencil and stabbed her with it. And it was not something that resonated. I knew it was wrong, but it wasn't something that resonated to me as guilt. Again, to your previous question, I felt sad that it had happened, that I felt that I needed to do it, but it wasn't, I hate this person and so I want to harm them, even though that's literally what it was. it wasn't on the inside. It wasn't, I want to hurt this child because she is X, Y, and Z. It was, I want the pressure in my brain to stop building. And I bet this is a quick way to make that happen. And it really did. I was shocked at how quickly the pressure vanished after that happened. And not only did the pressure vanish, but I felt almost a euphoric reaction to it, which registered later as problematic, yeah, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, that was what I was going to ask, is that how does it affect you to know that doing something like this brings you so much peace inside and so much sort of, I don't know, euphoria is a great, it's because it's not joy, but yeah.
No, it's not joy. It's elation. It's relief, because yeah, it's like, oh, the pressure's gone. It's a high, but again, it's not a high based on what I did. It's a high based on, oh, isn't it so nice to have this giant weight off of me? Mm-hmm. And I, again, that is something that I don't think is discussed when it comes to disorders of aggression. Certainly there are some people who harm other people because they get off on that act. But there are so many other people who engage in destructive behavior because there is something going on with them and they're trying to make their inner turmoil evaporate.
Yeah. I mean, I think, let's talk, like, step to the side for just a second though and talk about, like, some of the social messages that we all get about sociopathy in day-to-day life. Okay, so I mean, you saying that description is probably what some people who are big true crime fans would think, like, oh yeah, some of these people kill people because that it makes them feel exactly what you're describing, like they kill somebody and then, oh, the pressure's off. Or, you know, I don't know. We even talk about sociopaths in, like, in casual ways now where we're like, oh, my boss is such a sociopath, you know. Oh, I went on this terrible date, you know. Or, I mean, there's enough in there that makes it, like, sociopath equals something to be feared because of, you know, the suspect of, like, a story you just told. I mean, but what do you make of all that? Like, that messaging that goes along with this particular diagnosis?
I think to a certain extent it's earned. You know, there are people who have sociopathic personality who have committed atrocious crimes, but there are also narcissists who have done this. There are also people suffering from bipolar and borderline personality disorders who have done this. I think that old adage, if it bleeds, it leads. Mm. So the sociopathic personality has been defined by a very small percentage of the individuals who are suffering from it. So the sociopaths who the Ted Bundy example, for example, they comprise, I think the last time I checked, it was 0.01% of the population. Mm. And yet they've come to represent the totality of a disorder that affects roughly 5% of the population. And that's what's staggering to me. It's not that those types of sociopaths don't exist, because they do. It's just that collectively, that is so rare. Meanwhile, there are millions of other people who have sociopathic personality disorder, who cannot receive treatment, who cannot get the help that they need because they have been marginalized by this very, very small percentage of people who have come to define the disorder.
Do you find that people do react in fear if they are just meeting and you're like, I'm a sociopath?
Never.
Okay.
Isn't that interesting?
Interesting. Like, how do they, what is the response?
They smile. Yep. I really think it's because darkness to a certain extent is relatable, and people like the idea of being able to sit with somebody with whom they can share their deepest, darkest secrets, know that they won't be judged, know that they won't, that they'll be heard. And I have yet to encounter anybody who has been frightened or even upset. They want to know more. They want to know more about the personality type. They want to talk about their own impulses, their own, you know, sociopathic streaks. And that's always been really validating for me, because I think that most people, if they understood that not every sociopath was a Ted Bundy serial killer, I think that more people who were suffering from that disorder would feel comfortable coming forward and getting the help that they need.
Well, I mean, you definitely do get the sense in reading your book that you are almost like all isolated islands, even though it's a what you say is a big percentage of the population.
5%. So that's roughly the same percentage as people suffering from depressive disorders. And yet you can walk into any bookstore and you're going to find dozens of books on depression, how to treat it, how to live with someone who's coping with it, how to, you know, what support groups can be accessed for it. And yet the only thing you will find on sociopathy is how to spot one, how to run from one, how to protect yourself from one. And I can't think of another personality type that has that. Mm. I mean, it's astonishing to me that, that's where we are.
I mean, you were saying when you were even interested in this in college and trying to study it, that you couldn't even find it in a dictionary at that point.
I couldn't. And it's funny. I still have that dictionary that I, cause every once in a while I'll second guess myself. Like, is it really not in there? Did I miss it? Like what about, yeah, no, it's definitely not.
Interesting. Well, okay. So as a girl of 11, you get the chance to go visit a prison and you're introduced to the concept of a sociopath. And I love that you ask the person you're meeting with there, do all sociopaths end up in jail? And what was the answer that you got?
Unless they're really smart, he said. And he said it kind of offhand. It wasn't, you know, like a TED talk on it. He was, you know, a graveyard shift correction officer who, I mean, and by the way, that has to be the most fascinating, you know, type of a person. I could have spent, you know, the rest of my life chatting to that guy about everything he saw and observed. But yeah, it was just an offhand comment.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, you had never heard of a sociopath at that point, but did it, or had you, like, I mean, you're only 11, but does it change anything for you?
Well, I'd probably come across it at some point, but no, that was really the first time that I understood what it was. And again, it was this gentleman's description of the people that were in his prison, that they don't feel bad about the things that they do and they don't learn from their mistakes. So they keep doing the same stuff over and over again. And I remember thinking, well, I'm going to be one of the smart ones. I don't want to end up in jail. Mm-hmm. But you know, ultimately there were times when I got older that I found myself almost envious of the men in the prison in the sense that they were confined and therefore unable to act out on their compulsions. And I remember thinking, like, if I was in a cage and I couldn't act out, what would happen? Like, would my brain explode? Would I hurt myself? Like, I remember thinking how interesting that is, that I wonder if they're at peace in some way, which is obviously not, you know, to say that being in the prison system is anything peaceful. But I remember having that thought.
Do you have a sense of like how often you were doing something that you shouldn't be doing? Like, was it like every 2 days? Was it like once a week?
I think it was when the opportunity presented itself. Once I got older and I sort of put myself on a routine, that was different. But I think when I was a kid, if I remember, it was just any time I saw an opportunity, it's almost like I wanted to get ahead of it.
For instance, in the book, when you are at a sleepover and you realize like everybody's asleep right now and I'm the only one still up.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens in your head?
I just remember, well, it was, and I can't remember whether I get into this in the book, but I remember feeling that I didn't want to be there anymore and that I just wanted to go home. But I also remember feeling, I wish that I could just go to sleep. I wish that I didn't, like, yeah, I know I'm going to get up. I know I'm going to walk home. I know I'm going to walk through the neighborhood in the middle of the night, but wouldn't it be nice to just fall asleep like all these other normal kids and just be normal? Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I, you know, wasn't and didn't. I chose to walk home in the middle of the night and I enjoyed doing it. But I remember having often those conflicting thoughts of, again, I don't particularly want to do this, but the opportunity's here. So I'm gonna do it. But also, God, wouldn't it be nice to just mm-hmm. be normal?
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about the negatives, but I was curious in your opinion. So you were saying that you feel it's the social emotions that are harder, the ones that are like jealousy, guilt, shame. What else? Empathy, love. Remorse, mm-hmm. love, mm-hmm. love, interest. So those emotions, do you feel like there's a benefit to not feeling those things?
In some cases, 100%. I mean, I'm married to an Italian Catholic. And there's not a day that goes by that I'm like, I'm not saying, you know, glad I don't have any of that stuff. And I think to a large extent, you know, guilt is a helpful construct, but it's also extremely harmful. I have friends who are positively crippled by guilt and shame and that just endless spiral of people pleasing and what people think. And I do not suffer from that. And I am very grateful that I was spared that burden.
So when you're watching people who do experience these emotions, does it just feel ridiculous? Or like, I'm kind of wondering like, what is your perception of other people?
It's like a math problem that you can't solve, you know? So there's not a judgment of this is ridiculous. It's just like, why don't you just not care? Like, it's not something that registers that way. Like, I don't get that, you know? And it's, I try to understand it and I have a cognitive understanding of it, I think, but I can't relate to that. Mm-hmm. And certainly I can't relate to the idea of my actions being influenced negatively as a result of that. Mm. But they can't understand the way I deal with things either.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about love since you brought David up. David, he's your first boyfriend. And he's also the person you eventually end up marrying. He's, from what I understood in the book, kind of the first person that's not in your family, that you're just 100% honest with about who you are. Why do you think you were honest with him about it?
Because he gave me the space to be honest. And I think that that's, you know, I've had people ask, well, the way you met David and the way that you related and developed feelings for him seems really normal. And I would agree. I think it was a very normal beginning to a relationship, and that it was two people who were different, but allowed those differences to exist without judgment, without disappointment. Like there was I never felt the need to hide things from him. And again, my whole life I'd been sort of, you know, ducking and dodging, but with him, it was like, oh, I don't have to do that. I can just say, mm-hmm. I want to steal that, or I want to do this. And he might suggest I not do it, but I wasn't going to get the look from him. And that was a very safe place.
Do you have any sense like why he was like that? Why he was like, oh yeah, maybe don't steal that, but okay.
I think because he was young and probably just, you know, wanting to be cool and impress this girl that, you know, it's just like anybody, like when you meet somebody new, you might say you like something that you don't really like, or be okay with something that you might not really be okay with. If I had, knowing him now, it's like, oh, you're so full of shit.
I mean, and like, you have this real sense that he accepts you for who you are. And like, what was that like for you after feeling like you had to try to blend in with all these other people to fit in?
Oh my God, it's the best feeling ever. I mean, look, I think people talk a lot about the sociopathic mask, and that, you know, it's this sort of the front-facing persona that people with my personality type feel they have to wear. But I think it's also very relatable. Everybody has that persona that they have to put on, you know, whether they're at work or in places where they can't just be themselves. But for me, feeling like I had to wear that mask all the time, and then all of a sudden being around somebody who was like, yeah, you're going to wear that. It was like, oh my God, this is so nice. It was liberating. And it was really the first time that I was presented with someone who accepted the totality of me. And it was freeing in the sense that, oh wait, maybe I can have this normal existence. Maybe it won't be completely normal, but I can get a little slice of the pie.
it's interesting because when you talk about love, there's a one part, you guys come and go. Obviously, you met when you were very young, and you don't get married at 15. So
we didn't.
No. Okay. He comes and goes.
It would have been a very different book.
Yeah, and I mean, and so you have breakups. You have times when you go apart from one another, and you know, and it's love and sadness, but you don't experience a breakup like. With the kind of grief that a lot of your friends probably would.
I remember never forgetting about him, but it was very matter of fact. It was, and I can't remember whether I touch on this in the book, but I remember when I met him thinking, and I even went home and wrote it in my journal, I met the man I'm going to marry today. But there was no flourish to it. It was just very informational, matter of fact. And I remember when we stopped seeing each other, it was like, that's weird. Like, I thought I was going to marry that guy. Like, that's, I'd never had that feeling. And it was a very matter. It wasn't that. It was, you know, that sign is yellow. You know, this is blue. That I'm going to marry that guy that just walked in the door. So when that didn't happen, I was perplexed by it. So it was more of that like this puzzle that I was trying to put together that suddenly was like, wait, I had this piece. So that's, you know, it's kind of an odd response to your question, but it was more logical than emotional.
Yeah. And what was that like for him? Because, you know, coming from that guilt Catholic background, you know, the swirl of all the emotions there for him.
I don't think it really registered for him because he was older than me and off to college. So I think it was sayonara. He swears that's not true. He swears, oh, I always thought about you. I never forgot. But yeah, no, I don't think I was, I don't think I played a real big
He's
part.
Like, let the kid go to high school.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to talk a little bit about telling the truth because there's a chapter in the book where you fully confess to your father everything that you're about. And you're in, I think, college age at the point that you guys had the discussion. And you have a really interesting discussion about your different views on what constitutes a wrong thing to do. And I would love it if you would tell, like, the funeral story and how your views on it were different.
Oh, the funeral story. Yes. Okay. So I remember going with my, at this time I had been engaging in these destructive acts regularly as a type of prescription. And I remember a friend of my father's passed away and I went with him to the funeral. And when I was there, I was surrounded by all of these people who were so consumed by emotion. And I found that the stress, the stuck stress, the compulsion to act out just went away. And I wasn't sure why that happened, but I didn't care why. After that experience, I just started going to funerals by myself and just sort of crashing them. And when I told my dad what I was doing, he said, that's really wrong. And why is it wrong? And, you know, because my point was, I'm not disruptive. I'm not engaging with anyone. I'm not doing anything that would harm someone or upset someone. And he said, well, just the fact that you're going, that's what's wrong about it. And what I heard is, oh, I see. So what you're saying to me is, if you did something like this, you would feel badly about it. And he said, yeah, I'd feel bad. So that's why you would do it, because you would feel badly about it. Not because somebody's telling you that it's wrong, not because someone's kicking you out or arresting you. It's because you would feel badly. He said, yes, I don't have that. So without that, what I don't have that shame is what I think he was describing. Mm-hmm. You know, you're telling me that it's bad because you feel badly when you do it. That's not something that I have. So, and his response is, you know, how would you feel if something happened to me and some rando showed up at my funeral because they were trying to, you know, get a dose of emotion, and I spoke honestly and said, I would have no problem with it. And you know, he's like, well, most people don't feel that way. And I understood that. But again, it was a cognitive understanding. I was trying to communicate to him that I don't have those internal sort of boundaries that the shame or the guilt that keep me from doing things. I have to rely on external philosophies, logic or karma, which is why a lot of times when I went to these funerals, I would donate something or, you know, bring something as a way of sort of balancing the karmic scales.
Yeah, I love your father calls you a sociopath Buddhist. Yeah. And your therapist also describes you as an empathy seeking sociopath. Did you agree with her assessment of you?
Well, she said, oh, that's right. Yes, that's right. She was pointing out that when I looked across the park, there were when I looked across the street, there was a park across from her office where a couple dozen people had walked. They were walking through the grass, and I was like, you know, 1 in 25. That's what the prevalence is roughly. And she pointed out that matters to you because you're looking for somebody to see you. You're looking for someone to identify with you, which is empathy to a certain extent. You're looking for someone to empathize with your experience. And I didn't really get it at the time, but now having done so much research, I have really come to be astonished by the fact that sociopaths are shunned for failing to exhibit the very emotion that they are denied, which is empathy. And again, empathy is a learned emotion. Children are exposed to it mostly through modeling. So how can a child whose emotional experience has never aligned with empathy, how can that child be expected to emote it? Mm-hmm. And there's so much research that says that early intervention is so effective when it comes to this personality type, and that the most important type of intervention is socialization. You know, sociopaths don't learn how to internalize the social emotions like quote unquote normal kids, but they can learn it. They just need to learn it differently.
So I don't want to give away the whole journey about how you come to be who you are today, but I mean, you eventually sort of set a goal that you will, you know, stop making healthy choices. You will make healthy choices for yourself, not for your mom or for David. What is the difference in that approach for you when you decide it's got to be about me in this?
I think it's really what it would be like for anyone who wants to make a decision that sticks. You know, I have a friend who suffers from addiction, and he said I had to do it for myself. And I think, and I remember hearing him say that and thinking, oh yeah, I get what you mean, because if you are always relying on external, be it validators or pressures, one by one, those are going to fall. They're going to fade. You have to want something for yourself in order for it to stick. And ultimately that's what I wanted. I didn't want to course correct because David told me so, or my mom or my friends. I wanted to do it because I made the decision that I wanted to be authentic to who I was. And I wanted those decisions to be a reflection of that authenticity.
Well, and you also wanted to be a person who liked who you were.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, I think I probably always did, but I didn't. But it really wasn't until I had a full understanding of what was going on with me that I could advocate for myself, that I could say, okay, this is my personality type. This is why I do the things that I do. This is why I'm going to stop doing those things, and to hell with it.
Mm-hmm. So why did you want to write this book?
I really wanted people like me to feel seen, because I know that there are people living on the periphery, parents struggling with their kids, people struggling with their partners. And this book to me was a bridge to them to show that not all sociopaths are created equal. You can be sociopathic and educated. You can be sociopathic and married. You can be sociopathic and successful at your job, which really flies in the face of a lot of what pop culture has decided is possible for the sociopathic personality.
Mm, Okay. I thought this was interesting too. You write, normal people act out when their emotions become too stressful. Sociopaths act out when their lack of emotion becomes too stressful.
Yeah, that's really,
it's a brilliant writing right there.
It's just a really great summary of what it is. And if you are someone who is emotional and you find and you catch yourself acting out in those times of high emotion, high stress, you can recognize it in the moment and go, you know what? I'm not going to do this. I'm just having a hard day. I'm going to redirect. It's the exact same with disorders of, you know, aggressive disorders. Okay. I understand exactly why this is happening. So I'm going to redirect.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much. This was great.
Yes.
We here at The Bittersweet Life would like to thank Town Hall Seattle for presenting Patrick Gagné's and for inviting me to be the moderator. And of course, for sharing this recording so our listeners could hear it. I hope you enjoyed this different look at a personality type we've all heard much about, at least when it comes to crime thrillers and true crime podcasts. Maybe this will make you look at things a little differently as you walk around the world today. And until next time, this is The Bittersweet Life. I'm Katie Sewell. Talk to you next week. Bye.
Tiffany here, popping in to share with you a little slice of what it's going to be like on our Rome listener trip this coming October 2024. We're so excited to share our version of Rome with you, our secret, beautiful, and curated aspect of Rome that Katie and I have come to love over the years. We want to share that with you guys because, quite frankly, there's nothing else like it. You're going to be waking up to the sound of birds chirping in the courtyard, the beautiful, lush, flowering courtyard right outside your window. You'll be staying at the Hotel Donna Camilla Savelli, which is a gorgeous early 17th century restored monastery designed by one of the greatest architects of all time, Francesco Borromini. You can have your breakfast in that lush, flowering courtyard with a little bubbling fountain in the background, sipping a cappuccino, having a warm, piping hot cornetto right out of the oven, and all sorts of other yummy treats. And then you'll be meeting up with Katie and myself and the rest of our very, very intimate group. Remember, this is just a very small, select group. We're going to have 10 rooms, and we're capping it at that, 2 people maximum per room. And we'll be heading out into the city, mostly on foot. We'll be exploring and sharing with you some of those things that we have discovered, some things that we are extremely passionate about, and quite frankly, some things that most Romans have never even heard of, much less seen. Just to give you an example, we'll be taking you to an absolutely exquisite little chapel that some people call the Sistine Chapel of the Middle Ages. So beautiful and so little known that when I took my father-in-law there this past summer, and he has lived in Rome for almost his entire life, at least 40 years, he had never even heard of this place, much less seen it. We're going to take you to a place where there are literally 3 levels of history, one on top of the other. And as you walk downstairs, not only are you walking back in time, but you can feel the weight of history on you and smell it in the air as you go underground to explore these places. Katie and I will be with you every single morning of the trip for 5 mornings as we go off, way off the well-trod tourist track in Rome. And we go to places where even though there are thousands and thousands of people in Rome, thousands of visitors, some of the places that we go will be almost completely alone. Works of art by some of the greatest painters and sculptors in history. I just cannot wait to share my passion and Katie's passion as well for these places and for these things with you, our listeners. So if that sounds like something that you'd like to do, if you want to escape from the mundane day-to-day for a delightful week, a magical week, in early October of 2024, then get in touch with us The exact dates are the 6th to the 12th of October, 2024. Email us if you'd like more information. You can write to bittersweetlifepodcast@gmail.com. That's bittersweetlifepodcast@gmail.com. We hope to hear from you, and we hope to see you in Rome in October.